Bo Jackson's name still resonates with sports fans decades after his playing days ended. When Nike's Bo Knows campaign exploded across television screens in 1989, it wasn't just clever marketing. It captured something essential about a man who seemed to transcend human limitations. Jackson wasn't merely great at two sports, he was otherworldly in both. Even today, mention his name in any sports bar across America and you'll hear hushed tones of reverence. LeBron James once called him the greatest athlete ever, while Michael Jordan admitted, "Bo Jackson might be the only athlete better than me." What made Jackson's story so compelling wasn't just his athletic prowess, but the folk hero narrative that surrounded him. A poor kid from Bessemer, Alabama, who overcame tremendous odds to become a legend whose feats blurred the line between fact and fantasy. Vincent Edward Bo Jackson's early life in Bessemer, Alabama, was defined by crushing poverty and hardship. The eighth of Florence Bond's 10 children, he grew up in conditions almost unimaginable today, scavenging plastic bags to sell for pennies at local recycling centers, surviving primarily on grits and whatever wild game he and his siblings could hunt in the surrounding woods. His wardrobe consisted exclusively of hand-me-down clothing, often worn thin by multiple previous owners. His mother, struggling to raise 10 children alone, enforced discipline through harsh physical punishment, switches cut fresh from trees, metal pipes, and extension cords, creating a childhood environment where violence was normalized both at home and in the tough industrial neighborhood of Bessemer. Adding to his daily struggles, Bo developed a severe stutter that made him a target for constant ridicule at school. When classmates mocked his speech impediment, making exaggerated imitations of his halting words, young Vincent would wait until after school to exact revenge, earning a reputation for fierce fighting skills. This pattern established him as a feared fighter in elementary school, where he became known as the Little Rock Chucker for his uncanny accuracy throwing rocks at adversaries, a skill he developed defending himself against older kids in the neighborhood. Three pivotal incidents nearly derailed Jackson's future. First, at age 12, he nearly killed his cousin with a baseball bat after she took his ping pong paddle, stopping just short of a fatal blow. Second, he brought his mother's loaded shotgun to confront an older boy who had pushed him off his bicycle, only turning back at the last moment. And finally, after losing a schoolyard fight, he almost shot a classmate named Danny Terrell, only to have the gun mysteriously jam. In each case, something, whether divine intervention or an emerging moral conscience, stopped him from committing an irreversible act. Jackson's salvation came through organized sports, where his extraordinary natural athleticism found constructive purpose. His breakthrough moment occurred in ninth grade when track coach Dickie Acheson discovered Vincent could effortlessly high jump over 5 feet 6 inches without any formal training, a skill unknowingly developed from years of jumping his mother's 5.5-foot fence to escape punishment. In Acheson, the fatherless boy with a severe stutter finally found a positive male role model who recognized not just his athletic gifts, but his potential as a person. By his sophomore year at McCattery High School, Jackson had transformed into a remarkable physical specimen, standing 6 feet tall and weighing 195 pounds of pure muscle, with athletic abilities that seemed to defy human limitations. A profile in the Birmingham News dubbed him a Black Bruce Jenner for his decathlon-level versatility, and his achievements that spring were extraordinary, breaking Alabama's 3A state record in long jump with minimal technical training, throwing a no-hitter in baseball while maintaining a .400 batting average, and single-handedly leading McCattery High to the state track and field championship. Despite practicing in primitive conditions, using folding chairs as makeshift hurdles, and training on uneven dirt tracks, Jackson's raw talent was unmistakable, suggesting the emergence of a once-in-a-generation athlete. By his senior year, Bo Jackson had become a local sensation, drawing college recruiters from across the country. Unlike other highly recruited athletes who traveled extensively for campus visits, Jackson refused to leave Alabama, having ventured outside his home state only once for a church group trip to Atlanta's Six Flags. "I wasn't going to leave her alone," Jackson later explained about his mother. "She needed me, and I needed her." The recruitment battle ultimately narrowed to Auburn and Alabama. The fatal mistake in Alabama's pursuit came when defensive coordinator Ken Donahue told Jackson he wouldn't play until the end of your sophomore or beginning of your junior season, then added that Auburn will never beat us. Jackson later admitted, "Auburn was my second choice. I was going to Alabama before that day." Auburn's approach proved far more effective. Pat Dye personally visited Jackson's home, connecting with his mother Florence over coffee and tea bakes. Unlike other recruiters who promised special treatment and improper benefits, Dye offered Jackson honesty. "I'm going to treat you just like I treat the other kids. Once you get out there and you screw up, you're going to get burned." When Jackson mentioned wanting to play baseball and track in addition to football, Dye simply replied, "Fine." Jackson's arrival at Auburn in summer 1982 brought immediate culture shock, transitioning from Bessemer's small black neighborhood to Auburn's sprawling, predominantly white campus where only 2% of the student body was black. The racial climate remained deeply problematic during Jackson's freshman year, with Confederate flags prominently displayed and an annual Old South parade where white fraternity brothers dressed as Confederate soldiers while local black children were hired to dress as slaves. Despite these challenges, Jackson's physical abilities immediately stood out. He ran a 4.2-second 40-yard dash, the fastest ever recorded at Auburn. His physique was extraordinary, described by teammates as all muscle, like a tank from the future. In the weight room, veterans watched in awe as the freshman casually bench-pressed 350 pounds without a word. Jackson's college debut against Wake Forest was electric. After being found sound asleep across two folding chairs before the game while teammates paced nervously, he entered for Auburn's second possession and immediately showcased his extraordinary talent with an explosive 11-yard burst up the middle. Offensive coordinator Jack Crow turned to Coach Dye and exclaimed, "This guy is different level." Jackson finished with 123 yards and two touchdowns on just 10 carries in Auburn's 28-10 victory. On August 20, 1983, tragedy struck Auburn's football program when fullback Greg Pratt collapsed during Pat Dye's notorious training test 4, timed 440-yard runs in extreme heat and humidity. Despite being carried across the finish line by teammates, including Bo Jackson, Pratt died of heat stroke at age 20. At Pratt's funeral in Albany, Georgia, Jackson, Lionel James, and Coach Dye served as pallbearers. When it was his turn at the open casket, Jackson, tears streaming, took a photo with a disposable camera, something several other black players did as well. Despite this devastating loss, the team moved forward and Jackson's legend continued growing. His most iconic moment came during the 1982 Iron Bowl against Alabama. With Auburn trailing 22-17 and time running out, the Tigers drove to the Alabama 9-yard line. On 4th and inches, they called a play they had secretly practiced, bow over the top. Jackson planted his feet and soared over the line into the end zone, giving Auburn a 23-22 lead that would hold for their first victory over Alabama in 9 years. Jackson's baseball career at Auburn initially took a back seat to football, but when Paul Nix retired as baseball coach after 22 seasons, the door reopened for Jackson's return to the diamond. New coach Hal Baird immediately recognized Jackson's extraordinary potential. "He's the only guy I ever saw who made marked improvement day by day. That's how superior physically he was." Baird, who had pitched in the minor leagues and seen numerous future stars, observed something unprecedented in Jackson. "I saw 4 or 5 guys total who had the type of power Bo possesses. 3 or 4 who could run like he can, and 3 or 4 who could throw like he can. But those were 12 different people. It sounds like I'm talking about Superman." The most legendary moment of Jackson's collegiate baseball career came on April 2, 1985, during Georgia's first-ever night game at Foley Field. Against pitcher Larry Lyons, Jackson connected with a fastball that produced a sound like a cement truck slamming into another cement truck. The ball rocketed toward left center, clearing the 85-foot-high center field light pole and slamming into the light fixture itself while still rising. Neither the center fielder nor left fielder moved a muscle. When Jackson returned to the outfield after the inning, the previously hostile Georgia fans rose in a standing ovation and bowed in unison. On June 7, 1982, the New York Yankees selected Jackson in the second round, 50th overall, of the MLB amateur draft, a position that drastically underestimated his true potential. Because of his firm commitment to Auburn University, he fell far lower than his exceptional talent warranted. Baseball insiders widely agreed that had he been willing to commit solely to baseball, he would have been the unanimous first overall selection. The Yankees' persistent attempts to reach Jackson proved futile, as Auburn's athletic department representatives had been systematically undermining their efforts for months, strategically whispering that the Yankees organization was rotten to its core and that New York City would eat a bumpkin like Jackson for lunch. These tactics, combined with Jackson's genuine desire for a college education, effectively ended any chance of him signing with the Yankees. 4 years later, after a stellar college career, culminating in winning the 1985 Heisman Trophy as college football's best player, Jackson faced the pivotal decision that would define his professional career. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers selected him first overall in the 1986 NFL draft, but Jackson's visit to Tampa proved to be a disaster that would alter the course of sports history. The franchise's reputation was in tatters, notorious for its dilapidated facilities, dysfunctional management structure, and an owner, Hugh Culverhouse, widely known for being both miserly and openly bigoted. During what was meant to be a casual recruiting trip while bass fishing with Buccaneers players, veteran linebacker Scott Brantley delivered a brutally honest assessment that resonated deeply with Jackson. "Bo, we'd love to have you, but you do not want to be a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. This place is a fucking joke." The statement confirmed Jackson's worst suspicions about the organization. When Jackson visited the Kansas City Royals on May 30, initially skeptical GM John Schuerholz suspected they were merely being used as leverage in NFL negotiations, a common tactic among two-sport athletes. In a decisive moment, Schuerholz sat Jackson down in his office and asked directly, "Do you really want to play baseball?" Jackson's response was immediate and genuine, looking him straight in the eye and declaring, "Yes, I do. That's why I'm here." During his workout session, Jackson displayed both his natural talent and confidence during batting practice, noting with a characteristic sly grin that few Royals were hitting home runs. "Not a lot of these guys hitting the ball out of the park, huh? This looks easy." His raw power and athletic ability left the Royals staff awestruck. On June 20, Jackson sent shockwaves through the sports world by choosing baseball over football, signing with the Royals for $1,066,000, a substantial sum for a baseball rookie, but far less than the Buccaneers' lucrative offer of $4 million over 5 years. His decision, prioritizing personal satisfaction and long-term health over immediate financial gain, was a revolutionary moment in professional sports that would ultimately pave the way for his unprecedented dual-sport career. This choice, based on personal preference rather than financial calculation, established a pattern that would define his unique career path and challenge conventional wisdom about professional athletics. Jackson's first taste of professional baseball came with the AA Memphis Chicks, where his batting practice sessions became must-see events. Rich Doobie, the team's pitching coach, threw 28 pitches during one session. 9 flew over the outfield wall, not merely slightly over the 398-foot wall, but hitting the scaffolding of Memphis State's practice field beyond center. "He hit balls over the dawn," said Ed Allen, a Chicks outfielder. After a slow start in Memphis, Jackson's turnaround began with a grand slam against Greenville that measured an astounding 554 feet, clearing the 360-foot fence, 30 rows of bleachers, and 12-foot-high signs. His physical feats defied belief, beating out a ground ball to second base, throwing out a runner at home from the right field corner, and changing direction mid-throw to nail a runner at third. When Jackson joined the Kansas City Royals in September 1986, his raw talent continued to astonish teammates. During batting practice, he nearly hit the scoreboard in center field with a 470-foot blast. On September 14th against the Mariners, Jackson told catcher Jim Sundberg, "Hey Jim, watch how far I hit this," before launching a 475-foot home run, the longest in stadium history, off Mike Moore. But baseball was only half the story. After the 1987 baseball season ended, Jackson shocked the sports world by signing with the Los Angeles Raiders to play football as a hobby. On November 22nd against Denver, Jackson provided his first NFL highlight. Taking a pitch from quarterback Mark Wilson, he executed the bow reverse, spinning 360 degrees to freeze linebackers before charging directly into feared safety Mike Harden. Rather than trying to juke, Jackson lowered his shoulder and flattened Harden completely, continuing into the end zone. His defining football moment came on Monday Night Football against Seattle and trash-talking linebacker Brian Bosworth, who had publicly vowed to shut down Bo Jackson. The result was a nationally televised demolition. Jackson powered through Bosworth's attempt to tackle for a touchdown, humiliating the self-promoting linebacker. Jackson finished with a team record 221 yards on 18 carries in the Raiders' 37-14 victory. As Raiders quarterback Steve Buerland observed, that night, Bo killed the Boz, and then he buried the body. In 1989, Bo Jackson reached his athletic zenith. During a game against Seattle, he made what became an iconic play, a full-tilt throw from left field that perfectly nailed runner Harold Reynolds at home plate, leaving teammates and opponents in disbelief. The Mariners players crowded around a television monitor to watch replays, with Reynolds watching in stunned silence after approximately 15 viewings. "I'm telling you right now, the guy is superhuman," Reynolds said. By July 4, Jackson had 20 home runs and 20 stolen bases at the season's halfway point. When asked if he was pursuing the rare 40-40 milestone, Jackson dismissed it. "To hell with 40-40. You all are more concerned about it than I am." Meanwhile, Nike faced a challenge with their Bo Jackson endorsement. Despite his athletic brilliance, Jackson was considered boring as a personality. He was quiet, stuttered occasionally, avoided eye contact, and often seemed disinterested in media and fans. Nike's advertising team at Wieden Plus Kennedy developed a brilliant solution, the Bo Knows campaign for their new cross-trainer shoe. The minute-long commercial featured Jackson attempting various sports as stars from each field declared Bo Knows sport, culminating with musician Bo Diddley saying, "Bo, you don't know Diddley," after Jackson failed at playing guitar. When Jackson was voted an American League All-Star starter in July 1989, Nike seized the opportunity to debut the commercial during the game. The timing proved perfect when Jackson led off the 1989 All-Star game with a monstrous 448-foot home run to dead center field off Rick Ruschel. As former President Ronald Reagan provided commentary in the broadcast booth, Jackson's perfect swing sent the ball soaring over the wall, leaving players in both dugouts speechless. After the baseball season, Jackson returned to the Raiders for more football heroics. On October 29 against Washington, he delivered his most spectacular NFL run, a 73-yard touchdown where he broke multiple tackles with kung fu-like moves. 1 week later against Cincinnati, he ran for 159 yards, including a 92-yard touchdown. Jackson was averaging an astounding 7.4 yards per carry, prompting the Orange County Register's Steve Bischoff to declare, "Bo Jackson belongs on his own pedestal. Don't put him in the Hall of Fame. put him in the Louvre. The end came suddenly. During a playoff game against Cincinnati on January 13, 1991, Jackson took a handoff and burst through a hole created by Marcus Allen's block. After eluding safety David Fulcher with a stutter step, Jackson seemed destined for a touchdown until linebacker Kevin Walker charged from an angle and desperately wrapped his arms around Jackson's torso, sliding down to grab his right calf. That 0.1 second delay when Jackson stutter-stepped around Fulcher gave Walker just enough time to catch up. As Jackson continued forward with Walker hanging on to his calf like a 238-pound anchor, his left leg remained planted in the turf while his body's momentum carried forward. The result was a dislocated hip with severe vascular damage, an injury that would ultimately end his football career and forever alter his baseball trajectory. Despite the devastating diagnosis, Jackson refused to accept defeat. After the Kansas City Royals released him, the Chicago White Sox took a chance, installing a special $50,000 multi-depth hydrotherapy pool, quickly nicknamed Bo's Pool, in their new Comiskey Park specifically for his rehabilitation. Under trainer Herm Schneider's relentless guidance, Jackson worked harder than ever before, swimming, weightlifting, and stretching constantly. On April 4, 1992, Jackson underwent hip replacement surgery, an unprecedented procedure for an active professional athlete. Just 1 week later, defying orders to rest, Jackson attended a Chicago Bulls game with purple crutches at his side. "I was looking forward to this," he said. "I never looked forward to anything in my life. I couldn't wait to get rid of that person with the limp." 2 weeks later, his mother Florence died after battling colon cancer. This personal tragedy could have derailed his comeback, but instead, Jackson channeled his grief into determination. He relocated to Phoenix to train under Mack Newton, a pioneer in physical therapy who had developed his own recovery program after suffering severe injuries in Vietnam. "The program was brutal, 24 hours a day," Jackson recalled. "If you combined all the years I played sports, 23 years into 1 year, that's how hard." By late summer, Jackson was physically stronger than ever. Newton guaranteed the Boston Globe that Jackson would be ready for spring training 93. "You can't even tell which hip it is." On April 9, 1993, Jackson delivered a storybook moment when he hit a home run in his first at-bat of the season against the Yankees. The Comiskey Park press box erupted in applause, breaking the unwritten rule of journalistic neutrality. Though his statistics for 1993, 232, 16 homers, 45 RBI, 106 strikeouts, told the story of a below-average player, his contributions extended far beyond numbers. He became the team's emotional center, offering advice, humor, and perspective to teammates. Jackson's finest moment came September 27 against Seattle. With the White Sox needing a win to clinch the division, Jackson faced Dave Fleming in the sixth inning with two runners on and two outs in a scoreless game. After taking three balls, Jackson connected with Fleming's hanging changeup, launching a three-run homer that sent Comiskey Park into delirium. The White Sox won 4-2, clinching the American League West title. After one more season with the California Angels in 1994, Jackson quietly retired from professional sports. Unlike many athletes who struggle with the transition to civilian life, Jackson embraced it. He settled in suburban Chicago with his wife Linda and their three children, pursuing diverse interests from acting to business ventures to charitable work. When devastating tornadoes hit Alabama on April 27, 2011, killing 238 people and causing widespread destruction, Jackson watched in horror from his home. These were his people suffering in his home state. He had to help. Thus was born Bo Bikes Bama, an annual charity bicycle ride that has raised over $2.1 million for the Alabama Governor's Emergency Relief Fund. Today, approaching 60, Jackson's life is exactly what he wanted, pedestrian and uneventful. He lives comfortably in a large house with his wife of 35 years, has three children and one grandchild, hunts and fishes freely, drives a simple Dodge truck, shovels his own driveway, and grills his own steaks. He watches almost no sports except golf and feels no attachment to his former teams. What makes Bo Jackson the last folk hero is how he performed feats so spectacular they blur reality and myth in an era before everything could be instantly verified on social media. His legend lives on not just in highlight reels, but in the stories passed down, tales of impossible throws, superhuman strength, and a man who could excel at the highest level in two professional sports simultaneously. In an age of specialized athletes and carefully managed careers, there will never be another Bo Jackson, a true American folk hero whose exploits will be remembered long after the details have faded into legend.